she's doing better than us. She's only 3 months on the responsibility. So I think in the introduction part, Chair, is actually welcoming you like ourselves in this space, and just to say we do understand as fresh ones, you're much more later than us. We want to actually welcome you and actually appreciate that at least we have you to take us through the issues and the team that you will introduce. So can we welcome you and congratulate you as well in terms of your new responsibility, and allow that you actually take us through your presentation. Good morning. Is it morning?
No.
It's afternoon, Chair.
Okay. Good afternoon. Sorry, I'm just checking how long we've been here. Thank you. Floor is your chair. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair. Thank you. Chair and members of the Portfolio Committee, it is my pleasure to present the Competition Tribunal's 2018-2019 Annual Integrated Report, as well as our half-year performance on the non-financial and financial aspects. With me are my colleagues, Janine de Klerk, who is the Chief Operating Officer, and Tebogo Mkutle, who is the Head of Registry. On a personal note, as you mentioned, as the Chair mentioned, it has been a little over 3 months for me in the role of new Chair. I must acknowledge my predecessor, Norman Manoyam, for handing over a well-run institution. I give thanks to the management team of the Commission of the Tribunal that has extended a warm welcome, and I thank the Economic Development Department for its continued support. Turning then to the annual integrated report, this was tabled in Parliament on the 12th of October. I will start briefly by looking at who we are, what we do, how we do it, our performance, and finally the finances. The Commission has touched on the mandate of the Commission. As the Tribunal, we share a slightly different mandate, although our mandate emanates from the Competition Act, which came into force in 1999. The stated objectives have been looked at in detail by the Commission earlier. I will just sum it up by saying that the purpose of the Act is to promote competition in markets by delivering competitive prices and product choice for the consumer while ensuring the efficiency of markets as well as the impact on global markets and on small businesses locally. The objectives are underpinned by a market-based economy. So our job as a tribunal is to promote the efficiency of the economy and at the same time addressing public interest matters. We do this, and in fact we exist for two reasons. The first is for the control of mergers and acquisitions. Firms of a certain size are required to notify the Commission of their intention to merge and must obtain competition authority approval before they can implement their mergers. The second reason for our existence is to stem out anti-competitive conduct by firms, typically cartels and abuse of dominance. So we are one of a trio of competition law enforcers. The Commission acts as the prosecutor in the system. The Tribunal functions like a court, and the Competition Appeal Court hears appeals and acts as an appeal court for members that come from the Tribunal. Our constitutional mandate stems from Section 34, which confers the right to have disputes of law decided in a fair public hearing before a court or an appropriate administrative tribunal. To this end, our hearings are public. The media and anyone interested can attend. We hear cases that are brought to us by the Commission or in certain instances by private parties or the High Court. We must issue written reasons for our decisions. We can impose remedies such as administrative penalties in respect of anti-competitive behavior by firms. And in respect of measures, we can prohibit them, or we can approve them, or we can approve them subject to conditions. By way of caution, as the tribunal, we cannot set our own objectives, as our objectives are directly stipulated in the Act. We have no control over the number and types of cases that come to us. The case is dependent entirely on the referrals that the Commission brings to us and mergers that are subject to economic activity in the broader economy. And the cases are adjudicated on their own merits. But nevertheless, we have set ourselves three objectives, and we measure our performance against these three objectives. And the first objective is to ensure adjudicative excellence. The second one is to develop effective stakeholder relations. And the third one is to ensure that we are an accountable, transparent, and sustainable public entity. So how did we perform against these objectives? We had 215 matters in the 2018-2019 financial period. 106 were mergers, 99 of them were large mergers, and 6 were intermediate. We prohibited 2 large mergers, 22 were approved subject to conditions, 14 of the conditions were competition related, and 8 were public interest conditions. 45 cases were consent or settlement agreements concluded between the Commission and the respondent firms. 43 of the 45 were for cartel conduct, proving once again that leniency applications, a whistleblowing tool to uncover secret cartel behavior, which is otherwise difficult to detect, is an effective tool. The highest penalty imposed amounted to 98.9 million paid by a Japanese firm, Kawasaki Kisen Kaisa, for its role in a shipping cartel. 53 of the 99 mergers were decided within the prescribed 60-day period from when the merger was filed with the Commission, against 73 out of 121 in the prior period. This is satisfactory. There are 2 reasons that matters took longer than 60 days. Either the tribunal granted an extension at the request of the Commission for the Commission to further its investigation, or the parties were not available on the proposed tribunal date. Sometimes the matters also stay long at the tribunal to accommodate for procedural matters that arise before a matter can be heard on its merits. In all 46 matters which were heard outside the 60-day period, however, the decisions were made still within the procedural framework of the Act. The 14 mergers that were approved subject to conditions, as I mentioned, were conditions that were competition related. In one instance, the case was an IDC acquisition of a company called Glodina. The IDC controlled RRN and Colibri, which was a direct competitor of Glodina, and the IDC also controlled an upstream business which supplied cotton, which is required for making towels, which is where Glodina and Colibri were competing. And therefore, a concern was raised by the customers of Prila, Prila being the yarn manufacturing entity within the IDC, that they would be subjected to unfair competition in the sense that the IDC might prefer its own downstream toweling making businesses as opposed to the independent third-party competitors. The tribunal imposed a supply condition to ensure that Prila continued to supply yarn products on reasonable terms that were also non-discriminatory and were market-related. The mergers that were prohibited on public interest grounds included the Sibanye Lonmin matter, where Sibanye bought Lonmin, which was the troubled platinum mine. Trade unions and community organizations intervened to object to the merger or to have conditions imposed. The tribunal approved the merger, but subject to a number of conditions, including a six-month moratorium on retrenchment. Moving then to the cases that were prohibited, I'll mention very briefly. One was in the medical industry, where Mediclinic sought to acquire a private hospital in Potchefstroom called Matlosana. The concerns were that prices post-merger would rise, and after hearing the parties and the commission, we concluded in the end that the merger would reduce the number of competitors and would actually increase prices in the Potchefstroom area, and we prohibited the merger. The second merger that we prohibited involved two firms that manufacture large steel drums, which are used in the petrochemical industry. The firms were the only two in the country, and so the concern was that there would be a monopoly arising from the transaction. We found that the barriers to entry into the market were also high, and we therefore prohibited the merger despite the parties offering of a remedy which they thought would resolve the competition concerns. We didn't find that satisfactory. Then continuing with the measuring of the adjudicative process, the slide that you are looking at now shows the 215 cases that I referred to earlier that we were looking at in the course of this financial period. And this compares with the prior period, 2017 to 2018, where you can see that the numbers were 213 as opposed to 215. So the volume of matters appears to be constant, looking at the totals. What the table shows, however, is that there were less orders issued in 2018-2019 compared to the period before, and this is partly explained by the complexity of the issues and capacity constraints that we currently operate under, and I will say more about that later. The case volume seems to be constant because it's affected by factors beyond the competition tribunal. The next slide just gives an indication of the value of the transactions from the mergers and acquisitions that are filed with the commission, and we will just note that and move on to this next slide. In 2018-2019, we imposed fines totaling approximately 333 million rand for anti-competitive conduct across the 10 sectors that you see in the screen. The majority of these fines were brought to the tribunal as consent or settlement agreements between the commission and the respondent firms. This is usually in cartel cases, where there's already a whistleblower and therefore the parties come forward to try and settle. I've already mentioned that Kawasaki's fine was the highest at 98.9 million. And then just an example of a cartel case, and that's already been mentioned by the commission, a cartel case that has been contested, because with cartels, usually once there's a leniency applicant, there is settlement that follows. The banking case, however, is not such a case because it's one that has been contested, and as mentioned, it involved the fixing of the rand-dollar exchange rate. I will not dwell much on it because we have made a decision on the application to dismiss the commission's case. As the commission mentioned, the matter is on appeal. We dismissed it against foreign firms that didn't have a local presence in the country for jurisdictional reasons, and we ordered the commission to amplified papers insofar as the local banks and foreign firms with a presence in South Africa is concerned, because part of the jurisdictional issues relate to whether one can enforce against a firm that doesn't have a presence in South Africa. The matter is on appeal, as mentioned, and we shall await the outcome of that appeal on the 12th of December. The fines that have been imposed in respect of contested proceedings amount to 30 million of the 333 million that we looked at earlier. And the reason for that is that contested proceedings are usually far less than cartels, and they secondly take longer because they deal with much more difficult cases to prove, which are abuse cases. And in fact, 20 million of the fines that were imposed in the relevant period was against CompuTicket, which has already been mentioned. It had taken over 10 years for the case to be heard for various procedural reasons that had arisen before the matter could be heard on its merits. But on the abuse side and contested proceeding side, the fines are less. That's just really what that slide indicates. Which then takes us to the second objective or goal of our existence, the tribunal's strategic goals, which is stakeholder relationships. As mentioned, all our hearings are public. We had in the current or relevant period 13 schools visiting the tribunal when we were hearing a matter involving school uniform, which turned out to be of much interest to the school pupils or learners that came to attend. We reported, 2018-2019 year, there were 2,865 stories that were carried that included or involved competition tribunal work. We released 99 media statements to a subscriber base that grew by 20% from 3,854 to 4,640. We released 49 press statements and enjoyed 1,592 media reports in this 6-month period that we will be reporting on later. That there just shows that we have achieved the objectives that we had set for ourselves. We achieved and exceeded 3 of the 5, and 2 of them we partially achieved. The partial achievement was as a result of a customer survey which we had set out to do to get feedback on what customers have to say about the work that we do, and that was not undertaken in the time period that we had set for ourselves. Then turning to our third strategic goal, which is to be an accountable, transparent and sustainable public entity, we are pleased to announce that the tribunal has received a clean audit for its financial statements. We were awarded a trophy by the Auditor General for 2017-2018 audit. For the same period, we received a merit award of excellence from the South African Publication Forum. And for the third consecutive year, our annual integrated report won a merit award from the Chartered Secretaries of Southern Africa. The next slide just shows that we have exceeded our targets insofar as financial reporting is concerned. One of our targets relates to implementing a case management internship program in order to develop the necessary skills that contribute to the sustainability of the organization. And in 2018-2019, We employed 11 interns from demographically diverse backgrounds. 8 of them are Africans, 3 are white, 5 are male, and 6 are female. In total, the 11 interns received nearly 1,427 days in training at a cost of about 1.3 million. The impact on the interns is largely applauded by them, and in the annual report we do refer to the comments that they make. The next slide just gives an indication of some of the legislation that we have to comply with as a public entity that is looking to be accountable, transparent and sustainable. And those are some of the provisions that apply in our environment. The PFMA and the National Treasury Regulations require that a fraud prevention plan is included, and we have gone ahead to adopt a fraud prevention plan, and in fact have created a fraud prevention committee which forms one of our oversight committees from a governance perspective. The three committees are then the Audit Committee, the Fraud and Prevention Committee, and the Risk Committee. And for the reporting period, I am pleased to mention that no material risks have been identified by the various oversight committees. Moving then to the financial report, which is contained in the annual integrated report, I will hand over to my colleague, Janine, to just cover those aspects.
Thank you. So the first slide just gives you an overview of our budget and spend against the three strategic objectives that Mondo referred to earlier, and it also indicates the number of targets against each of those strategic objectives. So you will see that we have spent a fair proportion of our budget as planned, and then this next slide is, it gives you a little bit more detail because it includes the income. So you'll see there where our income streams come from over the 2 years. Government grants, filing fees and other income, with government grants making up the larger portion of our revenue, and then filing fees being the next largest component. This slide just gives you a breakdown on the expenditure categories. So we have personnel, admin expenses, part-time tribunal members fees, professional services, training and other operating expenses. So you'll see that the bulk of our expenses on personnel, with it being roughly 60% per year, and then the part-time tribunal members fees, those are people that, or the part-time members that sit on panels, making up just under 6 and just over 8 in the prior period. Our professional services also includes the cost of occupation on the DTI campus. So I don't think there's operating expenses include depreciation and then the transcription and recording services are also included in professional fees. We pay for all our court hearings to be transcribed and recorded. And I think that's all really on that aspect. And now I'll hand over back to Mondo to go through quarter one and quarter two.
Thank you. So moving on then to our quarter one and quarter two performance report. We have heard 89 matters over 73 hearing days, and we've had 216 person days spent in hearings. And how we calculate the number of person days is that because we have 3 panel members on any hearing, or in most hearings, we count the number of days by the number of tribunal members sitting on a case. So if we have 1 matter and 3 members sitting on a case, we count that as 3 person days, and that's what that number is. The part-time tribunal members account for about 28.7% of these days, and our variable costs of adjudication, which is essentially driven by the part-time members who are paid on a different remuneration rate to the full-timers, comes to about 1.98 million. The part-time tribunal members is 63.80%. The variable cost that Janine touched on, which is transcription services and others that she mentioned, is 1.98 million. The penalties total 37.46 million, and the press releases were 49 press releases for 49 mergers and 1,592 media reports on tribunal matters. The next slide shows a summary of the caseload from our case management system for the first half of the current year. And if you look at the last row, it shows the total. And you will see that we opened the year with 303 matters on the roll, and we received 116 new matters, and we have ended with 7 fewer matters at 296. While this shows that we are managing, it does indicate the capacity constraints, which I will come back to later. Turning then to the penalties in the half year to date, we've levied 37 million in fines, and again, consistent with the reporting in respect of the annual integrated report, most of the fines were for cartel, and only one was in the contested abuse of dominance case, which was in the manufacturing sector, and the fine there was 16.1 million approximately, and this case is on appeal. This case is the Uniplate case that the Commission referred to earlier. On the performance information, the slide there shows we have 26 performance targets, and we have indicated in the slide that we were looking at that we have only managed to achieve 2 of the 12 targets, which relate to the adjudicative strategic goal of the tribunal. The next 3 slides really indicate where we have not met the targets that we have set for ourselves. In some instances, we exceed them, and in others, we don't. The reasons for not meeting the target are set out in the next slide. Some of the targets that we have set for ourselves include setting down matters within a stipulated time frame. We have not been able to meet that objective, and the reasons for that include the fact that at times parties are not ready and they request other dates from what the tribunal proposes. In other instances, there is a shortage of tribunal members. In other instances, is the unavailability of part-time members who often are unable to sit in longer hearings. Part-time members have other work commitments of their full-time jobs, and therefore they are able to sit on what we call our Wednesday roll, which are normally your one-day merger hearings, in longer hearings which require up to 2 weeks and sometimes 3 weeks of continuous hearing. We then are not able to find tribunal members to hear those matters. The reason for the orders not being issued within the time frames is similar really to the ones given for the set downs. The addition here is that the reasons also sometimes take long to write because the issues are complex and require more deliberation among the panel members who sat on the case. And the reasons are largely written by the full-time members in most instances. And there are only 4 full-time members, and they are often unable to sit on hearings and write reasons at the same time. The next slide just talks to our income. We receive income from the government grants that we receive from the Department of Economic Development. We also receive income from fees that come from the merger filing fees that the parties pay when they file their mergers with the Commission. And then we also have the use of accumulated surpluses that we receive. The total of our income, as reflected there, is 61.6 million. And year to date, in terms of budget, we are sitting at 39.51 million. In respect of the operating surplus, I mentioned that we have 5.4 operating surplus. We expect that this will narrow as we fill vacancies, because as mentioned, we do have capacity constraints. In anticipation of the increased workload, we have sought to have new appointments to add to the capacity of the tribunal. In terms of the amendments, the Act made provision for 15 tribunal members. Currently, we have 10 tribunal members. Of the 10, 4 are full-time and 6 are part-time. We have sought to... We have sought permission to retain the surplus, because every year we have to apply to Treasury for the surplus to be given back. But for purposes of planning and certainty of income, we have requested that this should be made, the surplus should be granted. One of the things to mention is that the filing fees that the penalties that the parties are levied, that are levied against the parties, go to revenue and not to the competition authorities, and hence the budget is always something that we are mindful of in our operation. We then are looking forward. Amendments to the Competition Act came into force in July this year. As mentioned earlier, we expect the workload of the tribunal to increase based on these amendments. And therefore, the capacity constraints that we have mentioned are really to try and address the workload that's going to be coming from the new amendments, as well as dealing with the current workload, which we have been coping with but could do with more capacity. The next slide is about funding shortage, and I think I have already covered that in terms of the numbers, only 10 out of a maximum of 15 tribunal members. And we have made a request for capacity to be increased. I have gone through the slides very quickly in the interest of time, and I will end here and take questions.
Thank you very much, Chair. Maybe what we can do, we'll then ask the members to comment and or ask questions. Then we'll actually then pick it up from there. Honourable members, the floor is yours. Thring, I'm not sure if there are other members would like to make comments. Okay, Mbuyane. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Chair, I think that if we have the Audit Risk Fraud Prevention Committee from the Tribunal moving over to ESCOM and SAA and DEMEL and such like, perhaps we would then begin to see a turnaround. So congratulations on the work that has been done with those particular committees. Two questions, Chair. The first one has to do with the common law principle of retribution. Lex talionis, I think it is. My concern is who benefits where fines are levied and where monies are collected, where there's been anti-competitive behavior. Because certainly in this case, in almost all of the cases, the benefit does not go to the persons who have suffered the most as a result of the anti-competitive behavior of your company's cartels and so on. Is there not some thought being given to this to ensure that the common law principle of retribution actually applies? And then my second question is just what measures do you have, if any, to turn around the amount of time that it takes to come to a conclusion in a case? We've heard that the CompuTicket case took some 10 years to conclude. And it appears as if it was a small businessman who is struggling to keep his business afloat and maybe was found to be anti-competitive in his behavior, that particular person, my thinking is that the decision to prosecute would be very swift and very quick, purely because the small business does not have deep pockets. And it appears as if the deeper the pockets, the longer the cases are drawn out while they're trying to clean up behind them. So essentially, what measures, if any, are being put in place to look at turning around the times? Because judgment, effective judgment, is judgment that is swift and judgment that is fair, not delayed. Thank you, Chief.
Hey, thank you very much, Chairperson. Congratulations to the new appointment, Chairperson. Chair, maybe a few clarity-seeking questions for us to understand how do cartels get involved in water and sewer issues so that we understand exactly how the process moves. And how do the BBB policy influence the adjudication? An example of a smooth behind the reported of collusion behavior. So one other issue, the turnaround time for cases and queries is too long. Do you have any plan to shorten, or maybe the process of appointing tribunal members will be able to assist in the process of cases? And also check if, what do you do if tribunal members are not available for sitting or in the case? And what impact that has then on its own for members not being available? Do you have any strategy of having full-time tribunal members for sitting? I think I'll pause there for now, Chairperson. Thank you.
Maybe the point one would like to add is just say, Baba Mulder. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Appreciate it. I won't be long. I've got much to say. I want to commend the tribunal on the work that I've done. Perhaps we should replace the government with them. I just want to you didn't hear. Well, you laughed, so now what I want to ask is, it says here who we are. South Africa's got a market-based economy. subject to regulation. Competition policy exists within this framework, but it's well known that government do interfere with the economy quite a lot. There's lots of legislation which sets the example for that. What I want to know is in how many instances or cases are there anywhere government interference actually was the cause of the terminal to act, and whether if we take into account the state of state capture that we've had or experienced, how many government officials was involved, or were there such cases? Thank you, Chair.
Maybe the point which might be important to look at the issue of penalties. I'm not sure if ever we see that being a constant streaming in of resources in terms of what we are actually dealing with moving forward, because if it is, we may actually want to encourage the tribunal to engage with Treasury in a way that actually ensures that the penalties as resource are used to actually contribute back to the tribunal, so that the issues relating to, you know, resources for the institution are actually more secured. Further, I think the issue of relationships with schools and universities, it's actually very strategic, because I think we still have to do more work around the issue of education and awareness. If we invest more on that, it does actually help a great deal. But also, I think what has come through as a challenge is issues relating to capacity and skills, which I think the schools and university might be very strategic partners with the tribunal, if you actually have a more structured relationship. It will actually help a great deal, just to make sure that there's a constant actually inflow of capacity skills through those graduates and other people who might actually be involved in the school and university side. Mudawin, I see your hand.
Thanks, Chair. One question. Who's responsible for the appointment of tribunal members? Secondly, their unavailability in the entity, is it not going to make this entity to underperform? Thirdly, according to their appointment, are they supposed to be available how many times in a month or quarterly? Because I have a little bit concern with the way the entity is not getting their targets in order.
Then we will actually then come back to you, Chair, and the team for comments. Maybe if ever it's a response to question, to actually get your response to that. Floor is yours.
Thank you. So I'll start with a question about the common law principle of retribution. The fines, as I mentioned in the presentation, go to National Treasury, so we have no share of any of the penalties that are levied against the contravening firms. Insofar as retribution is concerned, under the Act, there is one provision that enables that, which is a damages claim that any party that has been harmed by the anti-competitive behavior can bring a damages claim against the companies concerned. That is a measure that has worked in some instances, and it has worked mainly for for business entities. I think the Commission mentioned earlier that part of the challenges that SAA has is because there has been a damages claim awarded against it by a competitor who took SAA on after the tribunal had fined it. So that avenue exists. It is not a widely used avenue, however, it does exist under the Act. The second retributive kind of act that has started to come out of matters that are coming before us is that in certain instances, in addition to administrative penalties, there have been instances where the contravening firm has been asked to create a fund which will go towards retribution to the concerned or affected individuals. For instance, in the bread cartel, there was a fund that was set up to as a retribution to those who were affected by the price fixing in that market. So that's another way in which retribution can happen. It does require creativity in terms of actually looking at whether those measures are reaching the people who need to be retributed towards. That's a separate matter. The second question that I think was asked was about measures that we are taking to ensure that our processes are speedier. Honorable Mbuyani mentioned the CompuTicket case, and it is an example of a case that has taken long in the system. I think in that instance, there were procedural matters on points of law that moved from the Commission to the Tribunal to the Competition Appeal Court, which are part of what happens in a litigious matter of this nature, where people exercise their right to a fair hearing and they exercise their right to an appeal if we decide something that they disagree with. So a part of the long or length of the cases is determined by factors outside the tribunal's control. But to the extent that we are able to control the processes when they are in our hands, we do have a case management system which helps us to monitor progress in terms of the cases. We have the targets that we have mentioned earlier, which is to set down matters within a particular time frame and to ensure we issue reasons within a particular time frame. So those targets help us monitor how fast or slowly a case is moving within our systems to the extent that it is not beyond our control. Where we do still have challenges is on the number of members that we have, and it's a question that also came up about the appointment of the members and that and how that comes about. So the appointment of tribunal members in terms of the Act is made by the President on the recommendation of the Minister, and the appointments also go through Cabinet, where Cabinet approves, then the ministers, the president can appoint the members. And so to the extent that the tribunal has been able to, we have made recommendations for the appointment of new members, and this has happened in the recent past since my assumption of office. And we are in discussion with the minister about the appointment of part-time members. It is a process that requires balance in the sense that in order to maintain the diversity of the demographics within the tribunal, one needs to balance that together with the skill sets that the job requires, and therefore it is a process of actually finding the right candidates who are able to do the job that the tribunal is required to do. Insofar as part-time members are concerned, these are academics from universities who are professors and they have a day job. Some of them are lawyers who are in private practice. and the appointments similarly are made by the president. And in terms of the availability of the part-time members, it is really a matter of contacting them to see whether they are available on a particular date or not. What we have tried to do in order to better manage their availability is we ask them to give us dates in advance, and that has worked to some extent. Sometimes those dates are not necessarily the dates that the parties are available on, and therefore it's always an ongoing challenge to deal with the part-time member availability. The request then for additional capacity will hopefully assist with this. At this point, as I mentioned, we have 4 full-time members, and everything then becomes their responsibility in terms of writing reasons, because the part-timers are not able to do that. Then the next question was about how waste management services or sewage companies get involved in price fixing. So this particular case was a case against EnviroServe. EnviroServe is a competitor of Wasteman, and their business is in waste management services, providing waste management services. They also own a landfill site called Fesserswalk. I think it's actually here in Cape Town, if I'm not mistaken. So they are joint ventures in a landfill site ownership or business, but they also collect waste to bring to their landfill site. So what they had and how this became a cartel is that they fixed prices of the landfill site use when their competitors come and dump their waste on their landfill site, because they were joint venture parties. And therefore, that is how we found their conduct to actually be an agreement to fix price, because they were fixing prices downstream rather upstream in respect of how much the landfill site, the waste management services businesses are going to be charged. So the question that was also asked about the Competition Act being a market-based or underpinned by a market-based economy, what we do as a tribunal is essentially to balance that market-based economy with the public interest issues that we are required to look at in terms of the Act. I don't know if I completely understood the question about state capture, and if you don't mind repeating that question, I will attempt to answer it.
Thank you, Chino. I just wanted to know whether you find cases where organs of the state or individuals who are involved with the state were involved in some of your investigations where you found them to be guilty actually of interfering, causing you to investigate?
I'm not aware of such instances. And then the question about, I'm not sure if it was a question, Chair, or an encouragement in respect of partnering with universities pursuant to the internship program that we run. We continue to do that. We have it's not a formalized partnership with universities in the area, and the interns that we have had have all come from universities in the area.
The expectation is that the commission and the tribunal should have better communication. I'm just saying as a point. And on the basis of that, which means you would find some of the stakeholders that get exposed to the system trying to actually make sure that they take advantage in moving from one area. Maybe they come to the commission. The case would actually have to come to the tribunal. I'm sure there will be sufficient communication or very clear communication between the tribunal and the commission, because you might find that those who actually come through the system, for lack of a better term, they may actually want to use what they see as advantages on the processes that might have not gone well in terms of the commission side. When they get to the tribunal, they may try and actually use what the commission has actually picked up to undermine what the tribunal's engagement would be. So using one against the other. Have you actually picked up any issue in that kind of arrangement? Or can we actually say you are working very well together and you are communicating well? Then it reduces that kind of exposure of those who actually come through your system. So I think that's one point which I think it's very important to be able to have a look at, because it's not a point that you are going to collude. The sense is that you know what are your responsibilities, but obviously there will be a case that moves from the commission to the tribunal, and there will be those stakeholders that will want to take advantage on the basis of actually coming through to the tribunal. So I'm just thinking, because it's two things. It's your working relationship, which is the first one, but the other point is actually the issue of stakeholders coming through the system undermining the relationship in a way that they want to actually take advantage of the environment, which may be less communication among yourself, or what they think they can actually benefit by undermining one or the other. It's a long question, but I thought on my part it does actually help us understand how well you work together or communicate in terms of actually managing those processes, because it moves from one place to the other. If you have a comment, that would be actually helpful. Are there any further comments from the committee, Mbuya?
Thank you, Chair. I think one was not responded to. In terms of the influence of the BBB policy in adjudication, and the other one will be cases dragged from along, like from that they go to appeal, like business people. They appeal, and I just want to check in terms of the percentage which they pay. Like one happened in the big company's construction industry, they just paid 10% of their income. I don't know whether they're interested in terms of the income, but that is very much minimal, and they do this deliberately because they know that they can be able to pay. So do you have maybe other strategies in dealing with that that affect the small business, and they are very much suffering in the process? Maybe that will be one check. Thank you.
We can take comments. If the commission would like to comment as well after. Let's take the tribunal.
Just responding with the question about the BEE policy, our legislative mandate also requires us to look into previously disadvantaged individuals and looking also at small businesses. So in mergers and in and acquisitions, we do look into those aspects to the extent that they arise. And in fact, some of the reasons we prohibited transactions were on the public interest grounds of a varied nature, including actually on a BEE aspect. I mentioned earlier a case involving steel drums, which was a merger between two steel drum manufacturers which were going to become a monopoly. This is Greif and Rheem. I mentioned it earlier. One of the considerations was that the merger was actually going to dilute the BEE aspect of the transaction because one of the firms was a BEE-controlled entity. And so we look at all of these things on a case-by-case basis because they arise in different contexts, in different cases, and we do pay attention to those. Then on the question of the construction industry and the fines that are paid, 10%, 10% is the maximum that can be imposed under the Act, and so we can't do more than that. There is, however, provision in the Act and in law in general that there is, for a second offence, you can go a higher penalty. And so the possibility of higher fines only arises when they contravene the Act. Again, in terms of when they've contravened once, the limit is on 10%, and there is not much more that one can levy. That is the maximum. On the relationship between the Commission and the Tribunal, we have had staff movement, very few, not a lot, between the Commission and the Tribunal in both directions. And in general, there is the awareness of the fact that people who have worked on cases that are still pending cannot be involved in the same case when you leave one organization into the other. You can't work on a case that was previously worked on. And so that is a case allocation system that we have internally to ensure that people are not on cases where they might be conflicted. As to the relationship with the Commission in general, we do collaborate on general matters such as the annual competition law conference that happened recently. We are constrained, obviously, to discuss any issues around cases that come up, but there is some collaboration on aspects that are of mutual interest.
Any comments from the Commission? Chair, thank you very much. Just briefly, I think the Chair of the Tribunal has said this. Of course, the two institutions are separate and independent in terms of the law. And the Tribunal is a court. We are the prosecutor. So on case-related issues, we cannot collaborate. You know, and I think as they respond to cases from us. We also maybe want cases to move faster as prosecutors, but these are legal processes sometimes that have to ensue. So I think that's the aspect. On other areas, and I think you are raising the issue on maybe supporting academia, because I think those other areas we can think about better ways of collaborating. So if we are supporting academic institutions to develop, let's say, competition law programs in the country, and probably there we can coordinate. We do coordinate on conferences. When we go to international fora like the OECD, you know, we do coordinate our activities because there we are talking about the position for South Africa. But the issue of stakeholders, of course, is our perceptions, but the stakeholders that we engage more with is business and lawyers. And when you ask, do they undermine the processes? I have to be very cautious and careful. But there's a sense that we get these legal challenges because there is no trust in the system. I think they still think they will get a better ruling elsewhere. So
So if the tribunal rules against these firms, the default position is to appeal. If the commission thinks there's a challenge, the default position is to defend and appeal until the end of time. So this is a general challenge of confidence in the system. And how do we inculcate that? How do we ensure there's confidence in that system? Is to show our independence in decision making. Is to show the robustness we follow in investigations. And I think the new Amendment Act has even increased the penalties, by the way. So for repeat offenders, it's not going to be 10% anymore. I think it's, I need to get this number right, I think it's 25%. The chair of the tribunal will help me. But this is what we see. But I think globally, there is confidence in the system. But internally, when we engage with lawyers, you can see you could be engaging as the commission. We think we have a common understanding on things. Once something else happens, you go to the tribunal, you are dealing with a different philosophy and approach. They go to the appeal court, it's a different thing, and constitutional court. But I think we're working on the system to make it robust, and this is our goal, and we'll make it a very robust and credible system, which we have done in the past 20 years, despite all of these attempts to undermine our effectiveness. Thank you.
Let me conclude the session. Next Tuesday, 26th November, we would actually be engaging with the NRCS and SABS in terms of their turnaround strategies. So we would actually be picking up on that. So allow me to thank the tribunal chair for the presentation, and I think a big welcome to you as well. I would ask that you be the last speaker to conclude our meeting today. If I can hand over to you.
Thank you, Chair and members, for the opportunity to address you on our annual report in the last 6 months. It has been enlightening to listen to the questions that have been asked. I think they have given a different perspective to how we think about the work that we do, and it has been an invaluable engagement, and I welcome it, and I look forward to working with the committee for the next 5 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.